Remember, episode 1000 is coming up fast, and I don't mean questions 1000, I mean absolute episode number, so it's coming up really, really fast. And for episode 1000 and the following episodes, Gail Carriger will be joining us to answer your questions. So send in your questions now to get in on the 1000 episode bonanza with special guest and multiple New York Times bestseller Gail Carriger. And now, on with the show. Welcome to The Everyday Novelist. My name is J. Daniel Sawyer, author of nearly 30 books, more than 30 short stories, and numerous articles and scripts and essays, coming to you from up in the crow's nest with my spyglass on this daily voyage through the dicey waters of business, craft, learning, and art in the writing life. Welcome to The Questions, episode 813. Today, Ian asks,
what steps should one take to protect both artistic and business integrity? I presume some of the steps are having your own corporation, website, mailing list, and so on, but if and when Amazon decides to have your payments or shuts down your Yeti romance genre or the Twitter haters mount a campaign against you, what practical steps can you take?
Well, okay, so rather than talking about business integrity, let's first talk about continuity, because that was a big part of your question. Anytime you're doing business with a major partner, this is true in any business, not just publishing. Anytime you're doing business and the lion's share of your income is coming from a single source, you are vulnerable to the whims of that source. In this case, for most of us, that source is Amazon and the Amazon ecosystems, places like Audible, etc. That's why the word diversification exists. The idea is you spread your risk over multiple different sets of customers and baskets so you're less vulnerable to any one event or whim taking you offline in terms of your business and your cash flow, etc. Now, in publishing and in other forms of business, you don't just do that by diversifying your customer base. You also do that by diversifying your product lines. So if you're writing Yeti romance or dinosaur romance or stepdaughter romance or whatever it is that the Blue Noses might come for next, because you know they will, people who are small-minded and hung up about things and want a little power join in crusades. And before you get too high and mighty about them, I bet you, that there is at least one moral panic crusade that's happened during your lifetime that you were at least severely tempted to sign up for. Remember that next time the moral panic wagon comes through with something appealing, because the issue with moral panics is not the validity of the cause. That's its own issue. The issue is the tactics employed and who they're going to empower when the dust settles. That's why moral panics are dangerous. It's not because people get their noses bent out of shape. That part's just aesthetically ugly and shows some of the worst parts of the human condition. The real problem with moral panics is that they sweep authoritarians into power. And it doesn't matter if they're authoritarians who are on your side on this issue, because on a future issue they won't be, and even if they are, the next wave of authoritarians that comes in certainly won't be on your side, but your side will have legitimized all the tools that they then use for their moral panic. So be careful about that. So step one, believe it or not, is to refrain from participating in moral panics and political wars in your industry, especially. In your industry, is, by the way, that's rain that started up. If you guys are hearing that in the background, it's quite lovely. And your industry is anything related to speech and expression. So stay out of the fights, or join on the side of the people who are defending the principles of free speech and free expression, because if those go away, your ability to make a living as a writer will too. And it doesn't matter how odious the people defending those rights are. They are, at the moment, your allies, because they're not going to wind up having power over what you publish when they win. They're fighting for nobody to have power over what you publish. On that issue, maybe that issue alone, they are your allies. But that genuinely, that's a basic game theoretic problem that people in the publishing industry have had since the publishing industry began, because artists tend to be people who are conversant with the language of the class that's in power. And so all too frequently, they get swept up in authoritarian culture wars and on the sides of the authoritarians most frequently because they're socialized in the institutions, they speak the language of the powerful, and they like to be able to maintain access to their customer base. So they don't want to take risks by offending the people who sit on whatever throne is in operation at the moment. But, on the other hand, when those things happen, eventually they do come and burn the books. And that has always happened. So you want to be sure that you got a foot out the back door. And that if you decide to fight, you fight on principle, you don't fight on expediency, because if you fight on expediency, eventually you're going to be on the losing side, and people will remember, and they will come for you. So that's step one. Step two is weigh your risk exposure. Diversify your distribution network, diversify your customer base, and diversify your publishing catalog over both different media and different subjects or genres or pen names, and diversify internationally in different markets. For two reasons. Number one, the authoritarian banhammer comes down in different markets for different reasons. When Amazon gets their nose bent out of shape in the US because some pressure group is putting pressure on them for whatever thoughts are deemed corrupting to the public morals at the moment, they're not going to be responding to the same pressure group in Japan, or, no, I won't use China because they'll respond to anything from China, or in India, or whatnot. They're going to have different pressure groups in those countries pressuring them to do different things. So it's good to diversify out internationally. Now, I know that with Amazon and with large international retailers and ebooks, you do have international distribution, but it's also worth looking at translations. Because it's one thing to have a presence in Japan as an English publisher. It's another to have your books translated into Japanese. This is a little harder to do. It can be more expensive. But in terms of long-term strategy, this should be something that is in your plan and on your to-do list, is getting translations done, picking the markets properly, maybe shopping. Because a lot of other countries have markets that are a different shape. They have healthier short fiction markets than we do in North America. They have healthier magazine markets, and they'd still buy novels and serialize them and things like that, things that used to be common here but aren't. So be looking at those things for sublicensure and whatnot. And we're going to come to sublicensure in another matter in a moment. So the next step is to use your income not for living on. Don't live on your writing income, because your writing income is undependable. Too many writers make this mistake. I made this mistake for the brief shining moment that I was making enough off my writing to have it be a living, mostly because my expenses were super low, and I hadn't actually figured this part of things out yet. Don't make the mistake of living on your writing income. When you live on your writing income, it's like over-harvesting your garden. What you want to do is use whatever your other income is. Whether you've got a pension from the military, or you've got a day job, or you do side work doing carpentry or producing other people's audiobooks or whatever it is. Whatever your other income is, live on that and save or reinvest all of your writing income. The difference between saving and reinvesting is not the difference between a savings account and a stock market account. By saving, I mean invest in something other than your publishing company and your writing education. And by reinvesting, I mean invest in your publishing company and your writing education. Saving can be real estate investment. It can be stock market, commodities market. So your outside investment is in those things or in other businesses. If you're making enough to give you some seed capital to do friends and family rounds on someone else's startup, that's also very high risk, but worth doing. And if you are at the level where you're about to break through to what the FTC calls a sophisticated investor, you get access to a whole bunch of other investment products that you wouldn't otherwise have access to, and many of them have really substantial, shockingly interesting upsides. But I'm assuming most of you aren't there yet, and I'm not quite there yet. I just happen to know about them because I circulated in that world for a while. Reinvestment means the direct and obvious things like your marketing budget, better covers, better layout, making sure you get all your stuff out in paperback, making sure you're into distribution channels that you might not otherwise have tried to get into because it requires you own your own big block of ISBN numbers, buying a big block of ISBN numbers, all these kinds of things. It also would include business and professional education, when and where appropriate, and it can include publishing other people's material. Whether you're starting a line of anthologies, or you have friends who are really good writers but really, really don't have it in them to run their own publishing business, or whether you are, like in our case, really good at producing audiobooks, and so you tend to keep your eyes peeled for audiobook rights that people aren't intending to exploit, but that you think that over the long term you'd be able to make a positive return on, and you make a deal for stuff like that. Those are all ways of reinvesting in your publishing business. The next thing is the legal protections and the strategic protections. Having a corporation of a sort that is appropriate to the type of business you're intending to run, and check out the book S-Corp versus C-Corp versus LLC, which is linked to in the show notes, is really important, and keeping the books and the records on them and treating it like a whole separate person than you. So the money for that doesn't flow through your household accounts. You don't take money out of it unless you're taking a disbursement or a payroll check. Your expenses are accounted separately. I learned all this stuff the hard way, guys. You really don't want to. It's a real pain when you get it wrong. And that's if you don't get in trouble for getting it wrong, which you can, and that's worse. I haven't gotten in trouble for getting it wrong, but I have cost myself significant time catching up and getting it right after years of doing it wrong, and it's no fun. And to do that right, you got to do your corporate records right, you got to do your money management right, and you got to learn about tax law. And that opens up many wonderful doors for creatively saving money that you can reinvest in your business that you might otherwise not have available, because if you were taking it as a small business person instead of as a corporation, it would all be taxed at basically double the rate of your personal income, because you would be having to pay payroll taxes on all of it, and it wouldn't be as above the line deductible in the same ways that it is if you're a corporation and you're only taking payment out of your company as a salary or as a royalty disbursement instead of taking it all in at the front and then marking stuff down on the back when it's deductible. Believe it or not, even though there's more bookkeeping to do, the bookkeeping is easier to do. And it certainly makes your tax accountant happy. Other forms of business security. Don't keep all your cash in one bank. And don't take all your payments through one payment processor. Have accounts everywhere. Even if you're not actively using it at the moment, anytime there's a new service, sign up for it, get it squared away so that if something happens and you need to hop, you can. And there's all sorts of things that can happen. Banks and payment processors fail and they go under. Banks and payment processors are subject to the same kind of blue nose prig censorship and moral panics that Amazon is. And actually, they tend to be more susceptible, which is really annoying. They can get hacked. Things can get stolen. They're targets for organized crime. All sorts of stuff can happen. The world is not a shiny, happy place, and you want to treat your business partners, including and especially your bank, as entities that are only mostly trustworthy and that can go down or quit on you at no notice. There are legal protections. Banks can't steal your money, but they can call you up suddenly in the middle of the night and say, "Hi, we've decided that we don't want your business anymore." And then what are you going to do? Well, if you don't have accounts elsewhere, you can't exactly transfer the money right out. So then you have to get it out in cash or in a cashier's check and then go and open an account just to keep doing business. Now, you want to have multiple accounts so that you can easily move from one place to another. You want to have accounts at banks, at credit unions, at domestic banks, at international banks, anything that you can get that allows you to move freely in uncertain times. You're not going to use all of them. You may not even use most of them. And if you're really lucky, you'll never have to use more than one of them. But if you happen to belong to a group whether it's an ethnic group or an interest group or a political faction or a religious group or a knitting circle, that suddenly winds up on the ass end of the culture war that's flailing around like a dragon with its head cut off, you don't want to have to stop your entire operation to deal with the fact that there are some people in this world that can't stand the fact that other people think differently than they do. So, since you know you're in that kind of an environment, and you do since you asked the question, you need to behave that way. And that brings us to personal security. How much of this you want to take is going to depend a lot on a lot of things about your living and family situation. And it can, this is a 2-hour talk. So instead of going through it, what I'm going to do is in the show notes, you will find links to posts by Brooke McNanty, aka Belle du Jour, and Maggie McNeil about concealing your identity and ensuring your personal security as a sex worker. We're not in the sex business, we're in the culture business, but really from the point of view of about half the people on this planet, and which half it is, depends on which way the political winds are blowing, especially if you write any form of erotica. We're in the same danger zones. They tend to come for the sex workers before they come for the novelists, but sometimes they do come for the novelists, and they come for us before they come for some of the other people. So we're like second tier on the cultural extermination list. So check that out in the show notes. And meantime, let's talk about the lovely, wonderfully nutritious, and healthy place that is Author Twitter. Here's the thing about Author Twitter, says the author who's on Twitter. Author Twitter, especially fiction authors, especially YA Twitter, has become the kind of performative, virtue-signaling, nutcase space that I have only ever seen in highly dysfunctional churches, in cults, and I've been in both, and in really, really toxic corners of fandom. And when I say really toxic, I mean take the normal level of toxicity in fandom and amp it way up. Basically, imagine all the smoffs who can't quite run a convention and so hate everybody else, and make it their business to try to take everybody down. That's kind of the baseline of Author Twitter. And the more you try to play up to the blue noses in this environment, the more they're your ally, the greater danger you are in being taken down. Because part of the thrill of the chase is the treachery. This is really hard for most people to understand, because most of us are only like this when we are on a massive revenge kick. But the people in this part of the author universe are on a massive revenge kick all the time. It's how they define their personal value. And so, part of the thrill when you're on a massive revenge kick is the seduction and the betrayal. You let someone cozy up to you, and then you watch them really, really hard until you find something that they've done wrong, and then you put it in your back pocket, and you wait until they annoy you. Then you deploy the back pocket option, and you blow their career up. This is very Machiavellian. It's one of the ways that intelligence services ensure the loyalty of their people. It was a great KGB tactic and Stasi tactic in the Cold War. It's what China has weaponized society-wide in their social credit system, and it's the way the authorial world works. When I complain about authors in that sort of snide, sarcastic way that I sometimes do, and then, quickly move on to another subject, this is what I'm talking about. You will find no group more nasty and dysfunctional than a group of artists who haven't quite made it and feel like they deserve it. And, you also find it among journalists and among political operatives. Fortunately, they all tend to swim in the same waters, and the same group of people tends to circulate in all three places. So, they're pretty easy to spot. But people nursing big resentment grudges because they feel like they're owed are seriously, seriously dangerous. And they will take it upon themselves to destroy you if they feel envious of you, or if they feel like you are making them look bad. If you do either of those things, you're gonna wind up in their crosshairs sooner or later. And it may be for something that you did 10 or 20 years ago, because they'll hold on to it. I've seen this up close and personal, both first and second hand, way too many times. The only way to protect yourself from that is to, there's a few ways. Make yourself bulletproof. Don't do anything in public that you mind being crucified for. If you say it or do it in public, assume that if someone has a problem with you, they can find out about it, and you be ready to answer for it, and stand by your thoughts and actions, or if you later decide they were incorrect, and then someone brings them up, straightforwardly say so. Don't be mealy-mouthed, don't be defensive, have the integrity to either stand by your actions or own up to the responsibility you feel you ought to take, but don't try to dodge it. Or ignore the storm altogether, because you can't keep a fire going without oxygen. Part of the outrage cycle depends upon the active participation of the victims. It's one of the things about most kinds of abuse that we don't like to talk about, because we don't like to think of victims as being at fault for their victimization. Victims are not at fault for their victimization, but victims do participate in the drama that allows the victimization to continue. Now, some victims don't have the sophistication to do that. I certainly didn't have the sophistication to know that when I was being terribly bullied as a child. I have friends that didn't have the sophistication to do that when they were being molested as children or beaten on by girlfriends and boyfriends when they were teenagers. But as adults, we have a little more sophistication than that. If the mob comes for you and you voluntarily engage for any reason other than you're spoiling for a fight too and you really want to play, which is legitimate, you have to bear in mind that you are helping to perpetuate the theater that is going on. It's an act. It's for attention. People that do this make their social bones, they get their social power and credibility by manipulating people into participating with them in their own immolation. So unless you are pretty sure you can destroy who's coming after you, ignore them. Because if you ignore them, you short-circuit the game they're playing, and they will go away after a few days or a few weeks. Now, yeah, you may lose reputational points. You may have fans that decide forever that you're an awful person because of this rumor they heard about you on Twitter that perpetuated through social media. You may have people who are genuinely about as smart as the toes of a chicken and decide that you are a genocidal maniac because you toured Auschwitz and took pictures, and therefore you must be a Nazi instead of perhaps a history buff or the child or the grandchild of a Jew that was interred there. I've seen that happen too. And that's going to hurt your bottom line. But you know what? You step out into public life, those are the chances you take. Other than that engagement strategy, another thing you can do is wear your transgressions on your sleeve. If you are doing something, or you are someone who is currently out of cultural favor, don't hide it. It's amazing the power you steal from people who thrive on scandal by refusing to be scandalous or scandalized. Let's say you're a woman who's in a polyamorous relationship with two other women. If that's common knowledge, it's going to take a lot more work to make it a social scandal than if it's something you were hiding because you were trying to write Amish romance. If you were trying to write Amish romance and then it came out that you're a lesbian living in San Francisco with her two other female lovers, one of whom is married to a man, oh my God, the scandal that would cost you your career. But if you wear that on your sleeve, okay, you might have trouble making inroads into the Amish romance market. But other than something like that, people are not going to get surprised when they're suddenly told this about you. And it's in your bio. In the end, the best strategy in the long run, unless the country you're living in goes completely totalitarian, in which case this will not work, is to behave with an uncharacteristic degree of integrity and be willing to stand by who you are. Now, if you're in a totalitarian system, that won't work, because they will burn you for it. But everywhere else, doing things that way will eventually help you weather the storm, no matter how nasty it gets. Now, the other thing to do, when the demons come, if they really do, if they succeed in making inroads against you and destroying your reputation, jump ship and start hanging out with the heretics, even if you don't like their thing. Because they've all been through it, and they can tell you how to make it through, and though they may never be your kind of people, or they may never agree with you on anything, even if they are your kind of people, they will admire you for weathering the storm, and they will give you access to their networks. So that's your backup plan. Well, that's all business stuff. Artistic integrity, it can be an outgrowth of personal integrity, but then I've known artists who have great artistic integrity and no personal integrity at all, so it's obviously not the same thing. Artistic integrity is really, really easy to lose when money enters the equation. Either because you're selling out, or because you're censoring yourself in order to ingratiate yourself with a patron. So if we're going to set artistic integrity completely aside from personal integrity, let's call it having the courage to be true to your creative vision. It doesn't mean that you stick with your original idea even if it doesn't work. It means that if you are trying to win the attention of a patron, for example, like in a crowdfunding situation or something more formal, that you're selling only what you're willing to sell. And you're not putting on the block stuff you wouldn't want to part with, stuff that will rob you in the long term of the ability to be true to your artistic vision. Now, if you lose your artistic integrity, it doesn't mean you can't get it back. But, for example, there are some people who write shared worlds and licensed properties and do ghostwriting who are really good at it and who enjoy it and for whom it is not a problem at all. There are other people who do those things and it sucks the vitality out of their work in the long term. They just wind up burning out because whatever they're not doing it for themselves. They're not doing it in a way that brings the best of them out into the work. And so eventually it is just work, and soul-destroying work at that. So it may take a little experimentation to find out which type you are, but if you are the former type, you're not endangering your artistic integrity by doing those sorts of things. If you're the latter type, you really are, and it will cost you. The other kind of artistic integrity, the more common one that I see, comes from success. It is really easy to be caught in the golden handcuffs. The thing about financial success as an artist is that the big successes are elusive. Some people can do it one time after another. Most people who have the big successes have one or two or three in their career. And the rest of the time, it settles back down to a level that for them is normal. It is really, really tough when that person is you to stick to doing what it is you do instead of trying to recreate over and over the singular beautiful success that connected with the world. Because that singular beautiful success that connected with the world, no matter how much you took the market into consideration when you wrote it, that was a success because it was from you. And when you try to clone that, it's like a movie studio. You'll notice this thing in Hollywood, or before Hollywood shut down and started flying apart because of this plague. You'll notice this thing in Hollywood where in the space of 6 months to a year, there'll be a bunch of movies on the same subject. It's because the scripts tend to circulate and the studios pass on them. And in the moment that another studio buys it, they're like, holy shit, did we miss something big? And they rush into production with the copy of that script they've got, thinly rewritten by someone else, so that they can cash in on what they're sure is going to be the new mania. And always in that kind of crop of films, the first one is somewhere between pretty good and amazing, and all the ones that follow, with very rare exception, suck donkey balls. When you try to duplicate a commercial success and you're not an author who is just able to consistently feel the market and hit the commercial sweet spot every time, then you're going to lose everything about you that made that commercial success happen in the first place. Because you don't know what those things are. You captured lightning in a bottle. You can't really make that into a factory. The best you can do is duplicate the creative conditions and hope that magic happens again. You can't recreate the success on purpose. You have to trust the process. And I'm sure all of you listening have that one author whose early books you love, and they were so fresh and new and good, and then after their first one or two big bestsellers, everything was the same. And you just slid away. And every once in a while you think of them and you think, man, I wish he wrote like he did when he was young and hungry. I wish she had the imagination that she used to. It's because those authors are trying to recreate those one or two shining successes, and in the process they've lost their artistic voice. What winds up getting lost is what made the first books special. So you don't want that to happen to you. And if you ever do get given a lot of money to continue the series, consider the long-term potential reputational costs to your brand and your trust with your audience if you do not deliver on those subsequent books in a way that is better for the audience and more daring in whatever way set you apart in the first place than the first books were. And if you can't do that, either take the money and realize that you might have to retire on it, or turn it down and go write something new. I don't know how I would choose in that situation. I haven't been there yet. Don't know if I will be, but if I am, I'll report back. I don't know how to advise anyone which one of those to take either, because that's a hard choice. There's value in both, and there's dangers in both, and there's wisdom in both and stupidity in both, and it's a really hard choice. But I think I covered it. We only recorded for 40 minutes. I think we covered every aspect of that question. Let's take another listen. So that basically covers everything. Control your business, have a good business structure, keep command of your mailing list and your contacts, diversify the businesses you're doing business with, keep backup plans around just in case the worst happens, but don't fret about them once you set them up. Make it maybe an annual, do I have everything covered? Check. And then just leave it out of your mind. There's no reason to be paranoid unless something is actually happening to you. Either engage directly for the fun of it or avoid entirely the Twitter mobs. Be prepared for the fact that public pillory is part of the price of entry if you get successful enough. The more successful you are, the more envious people you will generate and the more at risk you will be to feel their wrath. And be true to your artistic integrity, or if you're going to sell it out, be sure you know what you're doing. I think that covers it. Thank you very much for the question, Ian. Oh my god, this is going to be the longest episode ever. So I'm going to go spend 3 days editing this, but I'll still see you tomorrow.
The Everyday Novelist is written by J. Daniel Sawyer and presented by J. Daniel Sawyer and Kitty McKeon and is produced by Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. The text is copyright 2019 J. Daniel Sawyer and the production is copyright 2019 Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. This podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license and all other rights are reserved to their respective owners.
Join the conversation. Submit a question, leave a comment, or a creative death threat. Or find me at jdsawyeronminds.com or hit me at feedback@jdsawyer.net. We can't do it without you.